This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, Solomon Islands Foreign Minister explains why his country did a backflip after refusing to sign into Washington's new Pacific Partnership.
And there were some references that put us in a position that we'll have to choose sides, and we don't want to be placed that we have to choose.
And we'll also hear about how China could be running a disinformation campaign, accusing Australia and its allies of inciting the Honiara riots.
And they were active in pushing a narrative that foreign forces with ulterior motives were trying to smear the relationship between Solomon Islands and China.
And in Papua New Guinea, weeks after a deadly earthquake struck, families are still waiting for help.
A lot of people need help, like basic necessities, cooking utensils and bedding.
All that and more today on the show. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company. First, though, Vanuatu is just 1 week away from holding its snap election, with a full list of candidates set to be finalised today. The shock dissolution of parliament that triggered the vote happened less than 2 months ago, and that short time frame has prompted concerns over the preparation of the polls. To find out more, we're joined by the chairman of Vanuatu's Electoral Commission, Edward Kalamata. Good morning, Mr. Kalamata. Welcome to the programme.
Good morning.
So, Mr. Kaltamat, a lot has been talked about around the financial cost, the short preparation time for this election. Has your commission, the Electoral Commission, been giving the funding it needs and the resources it needs to run this election fairly and efficiently?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the funds that we were projected to conduct election was 150 million Fatu, and the fund was made available, I think it was two weeks ago. So the preparation is going well. The commission just finalized the list last night and made the official declaration. And the printing of ballot papers is...
Oh, are you there?
Sorry.
Mr. Kaltamat, it sounds like you're in a very...
The printing of ballot papers went well. The printing started yesterday. It's really a very short time frame, but we tried our best to complete all the activities that are in the work plan or operational plan. As I'm speaking now, the printing of rolls... was on yesterday until this morning. So I think we are okay. I think that the election should be fine. All the preparations, although some of the things that we were looking at now is a little bit delayed, but I think we'll get there.
And considering some of those delays, are you confident that everyone who's eligible to vote, not just in Vanuatu, but in foreign countries as well, that they will be able to get to the polls?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The proxy voting or the proxy facility has been used for people living in overseas, especially in New Zealand and Australia. New Caledonia is one of the polling stations too. So, two of the officers are traveling out this weekend to Noumea to ensure everything is ready before the election. There's not only within this country, but outside. We've been talking with ambassador. I think he in New Zealand is very helpful to ensure that the citizens who live in New Zealand also exercise their constitutional right to vote during that time. So we send in information on... Hello?
Yes. We're
Are you still there?
Yeah. Yes, we're still here. Yes, and you were talking about New Zealand's ambassadors who's helping with the voting. I mean, I know a lot of Ngāi Vanuatu citizens in New Zealand and in Australia are seasonal workers. They live in quite rural areas. Will they be able to get to these proxy voting stations?
That's a good question. I don't know what's happening there. We would just contact with the Vanuatu what to call consulate or ambassador in Australia and also in embassies in Australia and New Zealand. They're doing everything to help us to provide the avenue for people living there to exercise their right to vote.
But you're not sure. I mean, what has been the most difficult thing in terms of organizing this vote, considering the short preparation time? Do you feel like it's been a difficult job that you've been placed in?
Not really. We've done that in 2016. And we managed to conduct a very good election. That is credible and fair. The delay was the court case. Mm. The time frame was it's in the constitution that after the parliament comes to the end or retires, the time frame is 30-60 days. You have to don't conduct the election before 30 days and not after 60 days. So we did that. We managed to conduct the snap election in 2016. But I think the only problem we had now was the delay due to court, the court case. The result of the judgment came very late, not very late, of some weeks late. So we are confident that the election will happen on the 13th of October.
Okay, yes, that court case was sort of challenging the dissolution of parliament. And of course, it was that dissolution that triggered the vote. So I understand that court case. Yes, I'm sure you would have been watching it very closely, Mr. Kaltomat. If you are just joining us here on Pacific Beat, we are speaking to Mr. Edward Kaltomat. He's the Vanuatu Electoral Commission Chairman, and we're talking about that snap election that's happening just next week. The vote's supposed to take place on October the 13th. Now, as we've been talking about, Mr. Kaltomat, you've been, I understand it's hot off the presses, the printers are underway to put the final rolls in place. I understand a number of candidates, though, were found to be ineligible to run in the elections. Why was that?
We kept out more than 300 applications and received 225. The first declaration that went out was 180 were qualified. The rest was due to bad debts with the government, the government agencies. So we have to allow them 72 hours to sort the debts with the Vanuatu government.
It sounds like there's
so
a claim.
The 72 hours lapsed yesterday.
Okay.
At night. That's when. We went to the air again last night at around 9 to declare the final list.
Okay, so were there some candidates who did not pay their debts to the government in time and were struck off the list?
Yeah. Well, we have 225 applicants coming in, and as of... the first list was we managed to the commission managed to approve 180, and the rest was and yesterday we declared another 39 qualified after that 72 hours that was given to them.
Okay, so how many are on? How many candidates will be on the final list? Can you let us know?
180 plus 39.
Okay,
so
much is that? So that's there a bit over 200 then. So quite a long list there. The voting is set to begin on October 13, Thursday next
that's
week,
right.
About a week from now. How long will that voting period last?
from 7:30 to 4:30. It depends on the polling station. If it, it's bigger polling stations and people are still queuing, we'll allow extra hour for the voting. As you know, in Vanuatu, the polling stations are not closed. People have to work long hours. So we accommodate that in, I mean, if people are still standing there to vote, we can't close the polling. We have to allow them to vote.
And when will we have results? Does that mean October 13th, Thursday next week? By nighttime, we might have results about the new government?
No. Well, we'll have an preliminary result on the 13th at night. But then the final result, the commission has to sit after. So due to the distance and the traveling and transportation, we are expecting, the commission is expecting the ballot boxes to arrive in Port Vila after three days in the operational center in Port Vila. So we are expecting to start verifying the result after 3 days. So hopefully on the 23rd or 24th, the final result will be out.
Okay, so some busy times ahead. Just finally, as chairman of the Vanuatu Electoral Commission, what's left? What are the challenges, hurdles before that big vote next week? What's left for you and your team to do?
Fortunately, we have assistance from the Australian government. They're giving us C-27 and two helicopters to help with the logistics. It's very challenging in Vanuatu. Transportation is not reliable, we are lucky that the Australia came in to support us with the logistics. And I think one of the biggest challenges now is to get the ballot box to the polling station in time and to have the polling stations ready. And people are working on the ground, are doing their best to have that in place before the election on the 13th. We are hoping that everything will be sent out. The printing will be completed on the 7th. We have to compile everything in the ballot boxes and the election materials and ship them or fly them to the 352 polling stations in 18 constituencies in Vanuatu.
Oh my gosh, that is amazing. And so these helicopters Australia has provided will be flying, hopefully, the ballot boxes and the forms to these polling stations?
Yeah. Today or tomorrow they'll be doing the screening or scanning the airports on where they can land and drop the ballot boxes. But C-27 is doing a few airports that are good, that they can it can land on.
Oh my gosh! So and then for overseas, you're doing that as well. You're sending, you know, the by flight. I imagine the polling boxes, the cards, and everything.
Yeah. I said two officers are flying this weekend to Noumea. We have a police station in Noumea. That's the only out of country. Polling station that was designated by the commission.
Okay.
But in future, we're looking at putting more polling stations in other countries like in Australia, Fiji, maybe, and in New Zealand. But we're still working on that.
Go ahead. I was just going to say busy times ahead, and I wanted to wish you the best of luck, Mr. Kaltamat, in making sure every Ni Vanuatu has that democratic right to vote next week.
That's what we're trying to do. We're trying every best to provide access to every citizen to vote. The eligible voters to cast their vote. It's their right to vote. So we're trying every best. We're doing everything that we can to allow them to vote.
Yes, well, all the best, and we will see the outcome of that vote next week. That was the chairman of the Vanuatu Electoral Commission, Edward Kaltamat, there speaking to us about that very important snap election that's to take place on October 13th there in Vanuatu. And now new research suggests the Chinese government has been running a coordinated disinformation campaign in Solomon Islands, pushing the narrative that Australia and the US caused the riots which rocked the capital Honiara last year. The Australian Strategic Policy Institute study also found that Chinese diplomats have intensified efforts to attack Western countries in the wake of the political controversy surrounding the China-Solomon Islands Security Pact. ABC's foreign affairs reporter Stephen Judgetts has this report.
In November last year, Honiara exploded in violence. The causes were complex, but Blake Johnson from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute says the narrative being pushed by China's government was not.
The CCP sought to blame Australia, the US and Taiwan for instigating the riots, and they were active in pushing a narrative that foreign forces with ulterior motives were trying to smear the relationship between Solomon Islands and China.
The Institute has drilled down into information campaigns waged by Chinese officials and state media outlets over the last 12 months. For example, after the China-Solomon Islands Security Pact hit the headlines, stirring deep concern in Australia and the US, Beijing pumped out dozens of articles and statements accusing Canberra and Washington of bullying and colonial behaviour. Still, while the volume might be large, the results were mixed. Blake Johnson says few of the pieces got any traction by themselves on Facebook, where most Solomon Islanders get news online.
They were publishing an article nearly every second day, but only a handful of those were even shared into Pacific Island online Facebook groups. And even when they were receiving very little engagement and the comments were mostly negative towards China.
Beijing achieved more success by getting Solomon Islands media outlets to reproduce official Chinese statements, which were then debated on social media. Blake Johnson says negative comments about China dropped noticeably, while negative comments about the US and Australia increased slightly.
Because that gap is so large from the decades of support that Australia has provided to the region, it's not enough to just promote what the CCP is doing. They're also trying to take Australia down a peg as well.
And the delicately poised relationships between Australia, Solomon Islands and China will soon be in the public spotlight once again. Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manase Sogavare will land in Canberra later today, ahead of meetings with Anthony Albanese. Last week, Solomon Islands declared it wouldn't sign a US-Pacific joint declaration at a White House meeting with Joe Biden before doing a last-minute about-turn. Solomon Islands Foreign Minister Jeremiah Manele says they relented only when the US agreed to remove thinly veiled criticisms of China.
There were some references that put us in a position that we'll have to choose sides, and we don't want to be placed in a position that we have to choose sides.
And that's a message Mr. Sogavare will also deliver directly to Anthony Albanese.
That was Stephen Judgetts with that report. And just a note that the Australian Strategic Policy Institute mentioned in that story is an independent, non-partisan think tank and receives funding from Australian and overseas governments. And the ABC has approached the Chinese embassy in Australia for comment. And as we just heard briefly there, Solomon Islands' foreign minister says his country endorsed a Pacific partnership with the United States only after references to China were removed from the document. Solomon Islands, along with 13 Pacific countries, endorsed the partnership in Washington, D.C. last week, despite an earlier diplomatic note saying it would not back the deal. Foreign Minister Jeremiah Manele said he was uncomfortable with the first draft of that U.S. partnership.
In the initial draft, there were some references that we were not comfortable with. But then the officials under the discussions and negotiations, we were able to find common ground. And then that took us on board. So we signed. And there were some references that point that put us in a position that we'll have to choose sides, and we don't want to be placed in a position that we have to choose sides. So there was understanding, and there is understanding on that, and the draft was accommodative, and we signed on to it. Indirectly.
That was Foreign Minister Manele speaking to journalists there in New Zealand, and he also reiterated Solomon Islands' support for China.
question. Our security framework cooperation agreement with China, and I think I've made this clear on a number of occasions, it's basically based on our national security strategy. It's domestically focused. And of course, we are guided by the existing regional security arrangements that we have in place. And these are the Bikatawa Declaration as well as the Boy Declaration. I can assure you, as I've assured others, that there is no provision for a military base in that agreement. We welcome the U.S. Re-engagement with the Pacific, and we look forward to working with all our partners, my belief is this, and my hope is this, that the Indo-Pacific should be a region of peace, of cooperation, and of collaboration. And it should not be seen as a region of confrontation, of conflict, and of war.
That was Solomon Islands Foreign Minister Jeremiah Manele answering questions from journalists in New Zealand. Now for your Wednesday morning, it's time to find out what's making news around the Pacific. And to do that, I'm joined by Kyle Evans. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Priyanka.
Now, first let's head to Papua New Guinea, where police have shot dead a man. What has happened?
Yeah, so police in Lae have shot dead a man and injured another after confronting a group of men suspected of robbing a service station in West Taraka. So this is reported by the Post Courier this morning, who said the incident happened at 10 a.m. yesterday. And according to Lae police, more than five men allegedly held up the station before assaulting the owner, who had initially refused to hand over some cash. Police then allegedly confronted the group, shooting and injuring one. However, the rest managed to escape.
And do we know, I mean, if this was a robbery, was any money actually taken?
Yeah, so they did make off with 20,000 kina, which hasn't yet been recovered, or which hasn't been recovered. Police did, however, confiscate a factory-made pistol alleged to have been used in the robbery as well.
Oh, gosh. Well, let's head to some aviation news. There's reports of a plane load of passengers from the Pacific who got stranded at an airport. What happened? What airport was this?
Yeah, not any happier news, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So more than 100 passengers travelling from Samoa were forced to spend the night in a cold corridor while transiting through Auckland on the way to Australia. So this is reported by the New Zealand Herald, who say the passengers arrived in Auckland at 2 p.m. on Sunday and couldn't actually go through security screening because it wasn't staffed until 5 a.m. the next day. That meant children as well as elderly people were forced to lie on a cold floor all night, which obviously made for some pretty sad scenes.
Yes. Do we know what the airport or the airlines has to say about this?
So the Auckland Airport General Manager has spoken out. She said the flight was late to depart Samoa, and by the time it arrived, the security staff were all gone. That being said, she said the security terminal was supposed to be staffed from 5 until 11, but there was simply no staff to do so, which obviously speaks to some of those labour shortages we've been reporting on over the last few months. And not only that, but just airports in general, they tend to be a lot of subcontractors used, you know?
Really?
They don't tend to be managed under the one umbrella. So, yeah, obviously some issues there that probably need to be smoothed out.
Yes, and now let's head to some sporting news. Cook Islands are the last team to name their Rugby League World Cup squad. So who made the cut? I think we looked at Papua New Guinea yesterday.
Yeah, that's right.
What's
on
the bill for Cook Islands?
So the Cook Islands were the last team to name their squad. And they'll very much enter as underdogs, but they've still got a pretty solid team, to be honest. So a number of NRL and English Super League players named, as well as QRL players. NRL players include Davey Mawale, Tepe Moroa headline that list, alongside a slew of other familiar names. Parramatta's, wait for this name, Makahesi Makatoa, great name. Dylan Napper and Stephen and Essen Masters, they're all playing overseas at the moment, but a lot will remember them from their NRL days, all really handy players. Kale Itto is another exciting one, a young Cronulla player who's actually the reigning New South Wales Cup Player of the Year. He's the son of Kevin Itto and the nephew of Tony Itto, who is the coach.
Yeah.
So, yeah, really handy player there. So, yeah, pretty exciting.
Yes, and I always ask you this when you tell us these squads. What's your bet? Do you think that this team can, you know, cause some upsets in the World Cup?
It's going to be tough. They're not going to be easy beats, but they are playing in probably the toughest pool in the World Cup. They're actually one of three Pacific Islander teams in their group, so they'll have to face Tonga, PNG, as well as Wales up first. So you'd think they'll probably need to win two of those games to get out of the group stage, and obviously Tonga are among the tournament favourites, and PNG, as we mentioned yesterday, they're no slouches either. But I'm going to pick them to get up over Wales. I don't know a lot about Wales, but I know they've beaten them in the past. So, yeah, let's see.
All right. Yeah, bets are in. Let's see what happens. Thank you, Kyle, for those stories from around the region.
Thank you, Priyanka.
That was Kyle Evans bringing us the latest from around the Pacific, but it's a good time to let you know what's still to come in the show, what other stories around the Pacific we have for you. Still to come, we will find out the cost of running a regional sporting competition, or at least the approximate cost, because we'll be hearing from the Pacific Games CEO. Now, that dollar amount of running the Pacific Games has been the excuse put forward by Solomon Islands Prime Minister to controversially delay the national elections. So we did ask that question. What is that cost? So tune in to find out. And a song has been penned to help get climate change in front of the world's highest courts.
What is happening to our world? Have you ever stopped to notice?
We'll be speaking to the voice behind that track in about 10-15 minutes. And just after this very short break, we'll also be hearing about the ongoing struggles some communities in Papua New Guinea are facing almost a month after a deadly earthquake first struck.
Celebrate the pride of the Pacific.
You know, we're proud of our country and our heritage.
Stay up to date with all the latest sporting news.
So emotional every time you go out there and you sing the national anthem.
And hear inspiring stories from some of the Pacific's finest athletes.
I've grown so much confidence within myself, and I never thought I would be the player that I am today.
Watch That Pacific Sports Show, Wednesday nights at 7 PNG time on ABC Australia.
You are listening to ABC Radio Australia. Hope you're having a lovely Wednesday morning. Thanks for joining me here on Pacific Beat. It's been a month since a massive 7.6 magnitude earthquake struck PNG's Eastern Highlands, but local NGOs and community leaders say scores of people are still in desperate need of help. Students were displaced and many others left homeless, and there are fears that the real toll could be much higher, with communities cut off by landslides. Dubrovka Volodar has more.
The earthquake damaged buildings, roads and telecommunication towers and led to at least 7 deaths. The epicenter was near PNG's remote Highlands region. Billy Elia, chair of the Red Cross in the Eastern Highlands, says 3 weeks on and they're still seeing the effects of the disaster.
The latest is 1,776 students. They are currently displaced, and some students are residing in the town, while 50 students have decided to stay in a small classroom and they are overcrowded.
Kessie Sawang is the Member of Parliament for Rai Coast in Madang Province.
They have over 1,000 people that they are actually taking care of, and I have another group around 325 of them down at Saido stations. They had this violence and killings related to sorcery and death before. And on top of that, the earthquake has further disturbed them. So the assistance coming from the government is quite slow. So actually, my district has entered into a MOU with the faith-based organization. So they actually are delivering the much-needed relief and assistance at the moment.
Chris Walker from the Christian group New Tribes Mission has been delivering some of that aid.
Among medication and food and clothing that we've been asked to help with to help the displaced people, we've also actually been asked to send a number of temporary shelter tarps and or canvas so that people can still have shelter because houses were damaged in the earthquake. So it's just one humanitarian crisis on top of another.
Cassie Sawang says some communities at the heart of the epicenter have not received help. Roads have been inaccessible because of landslides and mobile towers have been destroyed.
These remote villages, they told me like their life is in constant fear now after the earthquake because of the landslips.
Back in the Eastern Highlands, Billy Elia says walking is the only way to get to communities. In some places, landslides have blocked paths, and even if roads are clear, he says there's no vehicles for his team to use.
A lot of people need help, like basic necessities, cooking utensils and beddings and water containers. The government didn't do a tight assessment too. No help has been coming from other NGOs too, especially the remote areas. So we can't assess because we don't have the vehicles.
Valachi Cagliata is the Secretary General of the Red Cross in PNG.
We've responded to one province, which is Medang province, but we're yet to respond to the other two provinces, Morobe and Eastern Highlands.
He says it's difficult taking relief supplies, including non-food items, to about 200 affected families in Morobe and the Eastern Highlands.
The reason is that we don't have NFIs. So trying to ship NFIs from Brisbane or Kuala Lumpur.
The Red Cross's Valachi Cagliata, ending that report by Dubravka Volodir. You're here on Pacific Beat, here on ABC Radio Australia. The financial burden of hosting the Pacific Games is the excuse Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manase Sogavare used to controversially postpone national elections. But just what is exactly the total size of that burden? Reporter Jordan Fennell put that question to Pacific Games Council CEO Andrew Minogue.
It's a good question, and I'm probably speculating on sort of giving an exact answer. There's parts that we know and parts that we're not quite sure of. And I'll just break it down. In terms of the Solomon Islands government, they've committed a Solomon Island dollars budget of $550 million towards the Pacific Games of 2023. And that's been broken into 5 years. So basically $110 million Solomon dollars a year for 5 years. And in, I guess, Australian dollar terms, you divide it by around five or six. So somewhere around 90 million Australian dollars. Now, those costs are largely to cover the operation of the games, actually putting the event on, and you know, all the employment opportunities, all the services that need to be run at the time of the games, all the equipment, running the venues and so on. Now, some of that money is also being earmarked for other projects in terms of some of the infrastructure. So, for example, Solomon Islands Football Federation are getting new pitches and a new training centre that comes in under that budget, as does the Institute of Sport, what they call CINUS, which is opened about a year ago. So the cost of that and operating that, which is open now, preparing the local athletes for games next year, is included. On top of that, you've then got the donor governments around the region who are putting in money in terms of facilities mainly to deliver all of the venues that are needed for the games. Now, this is where we don't always have the data on exactly how much it's costing, because some of those agreements are government to government and they're quite closely guarded. They don't necessarily come to us at the Pacific Games Council. Our only objective is to make sure that they will have the facilities on time to host the games. And provided they can assure us of that, how they pay for it and where the money comes from is often something that we don't need to be across. As long as we're comfortable, we've seen the plans, and we know they're going to be delivered on time.
And what's the breakdown of money being given by donor countries?
Australia have announced fairly recently $100 million Solomon dollars, around 17 million Australian, for some of those costs. Now, in that case, it's going to be refurbishing a lot of the accommodation in the schools that will be used as the athletes' village, and also some work they're doing around the water park for some facilities where we're going to be hosting a number of water sports during the games. So that's an example of of a donor arrangement that we have had some visibility over the numbers. Some others we don't. For example, China, building the main stadium and a few of the other venues and facilities. We don't know exactly what the costs of that are, but it would run into the tens of millions. And then there's other donor partners as well. New Zealand has done a little bit on the Honiara City multipurpose hall that's been refurbished. Japan is doing a lot of work on the main road at the airport, which are not specifically for the Games, but are going to be vitally important for the Games to run smoothly.
Interesting, yeah, that you don't necessarily have all the oversight, I suppose, of that money. Are you comfortable with the different donors who perhaps haven't given that transparency to the amount of money coming through? And I guess, is it as long as they're hitting their timelines and everything, the Games are comfortable in just watching that play out, I suppose?
Yes, I think what probably needs to be understood here with a question like that is these donor arrangements in providing infrastructure to support the delivery of the Pacific Games have been going back at least two decades. The first time I attended what was then South Pacific Games was in Fiji in 2003, where a lot of the facilities there, which still exist in Suva, were provided under similar donor arrangements. So this is a very normal thing. Samoa had the Games in both 2007 and 2019, where there were similar donor arrangements. This is a normal thing for us as the Games Council to see and have sort of oversight of. It's not something that's new in 2023 in Solomon Islands, even though it is new for their country, having not had the Games before. The donors are predominantly China, but there have been other players involved as well, including Australia. The provision of those facilities has always been in a timely manner and enabled us to deliver the Games on time.
You were saying that the Solomon Islands itself has put in about 100 million Solomon's dollars each year for 5 years. Is that up until 2023, or how does that sort of get mapped out?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, there's sort of a whole of Games commitment of 550 million Solomon dollars. I think the timing on some of those annual payments has not always been sort of evenly 110, 110, 110, so on. But that is their commitment over the 5 year period.
Can I ask if you know how much of that money has already been spent from the Solomon Islands government up till now, 2022?
Not the majority of it. I think the majority of the spend will come sort of towards the end of this year and all through next year. I mean, a lot of the operational costs of the Games are Games time. It's all the food for the athletes. It's all the cleaning services of the venues and the accommodation. It's all the transport that you need to get all the athletes around to the various venues. A lot of those costs, the broadcasting and a whole lot of others, come in sort of right at the end. So the majority of those funds will be deployed, I guess, over the next 15 or 16 months.
And so, doing quick maths from what you've told me, am I right in saying that altogether the Games will cost around 150 million Australian dollars? And how does that compare to costs of other Pacific Games?
Probably, I don't know, I'd be speculating.
Yeah, okay.
I'd say it was 200 or 200 plus, but I mean, it's nowhere near the most expensive. Back in 2015 in Port Moresby, the Papua New Guinea government basically funded the construction of an entirely new suite of venues in Port Moresby to host those Games. The total Games cost back then was about 1.5 billion kina, which was somewhere near, I guess, about 500 million Australian dollars. They were a big Games, big population, of course, in Port Moresby, and the facilities that were needed in that city for the emerging generations of young people meant that the venues were quite a bit bigger than what we're going to see next year in Honiara. This won't be the most expensive Pacific Games we've ever seen, and far from it.
That was Pacific Games CEO Andrew Minogue speaking there to our reporter, Jordan Fennell. Thanks for joining us this Wednesday morning on Pacific Beat. Vanuatu has been pushing the International Court of Justice to protect vulnerable nations from climate change. Their bid for an advisory opinion has gathered lots of support from world leaders to thousands of civil society organizations. And now another voice has joined that chorus.
What is happening to our world? Have you ever stopped to notice?
That's famed Ni Vanuatu artist Vanessa Kwai, who's released a new song called Climate Change at the International Court of Justice. And she joins me now on the line. Good morning to you, Vanessa.
Hi, good morning.
So I wanted to hear about the background to the song. Why did you get involved in creating this song as part of the ICJ campaign?
Okay, thank you. I was approached by Christopher Bartlett. He's one of the coordinators, I believe, for climate justice here in Vanuatu. And he asked me if I was able to be a part of them with their project, creating a song, yes, for the ICJ.
And why did you say yes? Why did you say yes?
Oh, yeah. I'm an artist back here in Vanuatu. I do songs that you know, wants to bring messages through my songs, including awareness, positive messages. So that's why I said yes to his offer, because I see that climate change is one of the issues that's happening around the Pacific.
And did you write the song, or were you given the song and they wanted your voice?
No, actually, he asked me if we can put the lyrics, plot down lyrics, and I said yes, okay. And they gave us some keywords, and we put the song, the lyrics together, and that's how the song, was made.
Wow, that must be quite difficult, because often we hear songs, you know, about somewhat normal things, whereas climate change and particularly this International Court of Justice is quite a complex idea. Was it difficult to write these lyrics?
It was difficult for me as an artist, and also other artists that was featured in the song, because we find it difficult because our writing is more poetic. But Christopher and his team suggested some of the lyrics to us, so we had to find ways to how to put these lyrics into melody, and so
And
it
you
came
said,
out well, yes.
Yes, and we'll take a listen coming up. And you said the reason why you wanted to get involved is because you see the impacts of climate change on the region. Has climate change impacted you at all? Were you able to add your own personal experience into the song?
Yes, I can say that climate change is a big issue, because we faced, especially in Vanuatu, we faced a lot of natural disasters, especially cyclones. We've had two big cyclones, Category 5, that hit us, and it did affected us. Yes, it affected my home and my family's, yes.
And why do you what impact do you want this song to have? It's linked to this International Court of Justice advisory opinion that advocates hope to get them to have an opinion or make an advisory opinion on climate change. That's what the lobby is about. Do you hope that people, you know, who can make those decisions, which I understand are UN members, will listen to this song? Or do you have any other aims that you want the song to accomplish?
Well, the main goal here is for the message to be heard through this song. I believe that the awareness of climate change has already been going on. But we just want to put this message that we like to let the UN hear this, or the International Justice Court to hear this song, and to hear that we are voicing our voice again, that we want this to stop. So that's how we want to put this in the lyrics.
Yes, and Vanessa, you know, you're part of, a long line of artists and musicians who've, you know, penned songs for climate, for social change, and political change. You know, Bob Dylan with his song "Blowing in the Wind" for civil rights. Here in Australia, Yothu Yindi, they had the treaty song, fighting for Indigenous First Nations rights. Do you have a lot of songs that have these social issues underlying then? What sort of power does music have to bring about change?
I believe music is a very powerful tool to use to bring out, you know, to voice out a person's, you know, or community or society's, concerns. Or so I believe music can use this to because I believe music unites people and it touches the soul of a person. So yeah, I believe music is powerful to use to voice out the cries of the people. And so that's why I use music to be that voice to change, to, you know, try help change something. Yes.
And Vanessa, this new song is called Climate Change at the International Court of Justice. Have people started listening to it? What response have you had to the song so far?
Well, we had a launching of this song here, happened in Port Vila maybe 2 weeks ago. And it was a really good, huge impact because everybody listened to the song. Every people who live in Port Vila, the message of the song was sent out. And I believe we sang the song to our political leaders who was there at the launching, including our president. So our president was really impacted by this song. He literally cried when he heard the song. So I believe that song had an impact. And I believe that other people around the nations who hear this song, I believe it will impact them somehow.
And we'll take a listen to this song very shortly. And as listeners, you know, around the Pacific, take a listen. Is there anything that you hope that they feel? Is there anything, any message, any words beyond the song itself that you want to share with them?
I just want to say thank you to you for giving me the opportunity to be part of this interview. And I believe that, just want to encourage people who listen to this song that, climate change is a big issue. And whatever we can do to be a voice or to do something so that we can change or stop climate change will be good. Yeah, thank you.
Vanessa Quaid, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Pacific Beat.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. And as I mentioned, let's take a listen to her song. This is Climate Change at the International Court of Justice by Vanessa Quaid.
What is happening to our world? Have you ever stopped to notice? What does it take for you to see? Lives are being lost. With all the storms raging, corals dying, ocean levels rising, it's a threat to our human rights. Fossil fuels burning us past 1.5 degrees. What are we gaining from this madness? Our people are in danger. We're calling out to you, International Court of Justice. We're calling out to you, United Nations. Meet us up today. Protect the rights of the human race. We're calling out to you.
Yeah, we have a duty to all of mankind. Legal obligations must stand to defend our rights.
This chance to get clarity.
from the International Court of Justice on the legal obligations. In a struggle for survival with a million voices, save the Paris Agreement, everyone must act. So better mankind, wake up now, it's not too late. Raise your voices up, speak for the children of tomorrow. With every forest burning, every person moving, every day is passing by, and time is running out. Bit by bit, the world is heating over, and it seems to never end. We're calling out again.
We're calling out to you, International Court of Justice, an advisory opinion on human rights and climate change.
That is the Climate Change at the International Court of Justice, a song by Vanessa Quay, Stan and the Earth Force. And if you want to hear listen to the whole song, you can find that on YouTube. Because this is the end of the show. I hope you have a lovely day, and I'll be with you again tomorrow morning.